Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count for your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Please be advised. The following episode contains scenes of an extremely graphic nature that may be distressing for some listeners. As the flames rolled ever higher into the night sky, the thick clouds that had been so grey only hours before were now lit up, turning a strange shade of sanguine in the process. It gave the impression, if only just for a moment, that it wasn't drops of rain that were falling, but drops of blood. As the merciless downpour continued, mixed with flashes of lightning and eruptions of thunder, it was as if everything had been turned on its head. The heavens above replaced by the bowels of hell. But where heaven had gone to exactly, none could say. For surely, wherever it was, it certainly wasn't down here. The East End of London, 1888. The fires had begun sometime in the evening, the first having broken out at the South Quay warehouses. A scent of charcoal had blown softly through the streets before the fire announced itself with an immense explosion from out of the dockyard. Before long, 200 yards of warehouse, stuffed with the dubious spoils of colonial practices, were ablaze under that reddening August sky, flashing with electricity. Each jagged discharge appearing like rips in the air, cracks that might at any point be opened up for something abominable to come through. 3 hours later, with the help of 12 steam pumper fire engines, and almost 100 firefighters, the flames were subdued, and the men able to return to their beds. But chaos will not be stilled. At shortly before 1 o'clock, another call came in. A second fire had broken out at Ratcliffe Dry Dock, even more devastating than the first. A large two-story warehouse was soon consumed. The flames then danced on the wind across the yard and set light to a sailing ship fresh in for repairs before making their way to the motherload, a 120-foot long warehouse stuffed with 800 tons of coal. Hundreds of nearby residents crammed into the surrounding tenements, now threatened by the flames, poured into the street fearing for their lives. Others drawn in by the strange confluence of chaos, beauty, and destruction, came simply to watch the ominous spectacle. One face among them was 50-year-old Emily Holland, a long-time resident of the East End's Whitechapel district, a woman for whom the spectacle was a welcome respite from the hellish existence of a life spent on the margins of society, doing anything to stay afloat in the gutter, where any distraction from the sheer truth of it all was about as much as you could hope for. You're listening to Unexplained, and I'm Richard MacLean Smith. Having seen enough of the fire, Emily set off back towards Wilmot's, a roughly 20-minute walk away, where she shared one room with five other women. Framed by the deep red sky above, she made her way west along the main thoroughfare of Commercial Road, careful to stay away from the many narrow roads and unlit alleyways that branched off it, for she was only too aware of what horrors might await women who walk through such places alone. No doubt, each of them had a story. 5 months previously, 45-year-old local resident Emma Smith was brutally raped and beaten on an unlit corner of nearby Brick Lane by four young men who finished their assault by jabbing a blunt object into her vagina, ripping through the internal wall. After the assault, Smith had stood up and walked alone back to her lodgings. Against her will, the lodgings manager helped her to a nearby hospital, where she later succumbed to her injuries. Only 3 weeks ago, the body of 39-year-old Martha Tabram was found in the stairwell of a building on George Yard, which ran parallel to Brick Lane. Tabram, who occasionally carried out sex work, had been last seen heading off with a client before her body was discovered in a pool of blood, left displayed in such a way by her killer in an effort to inflict maximum shame on the woman. She had been stabbed 21 times across the body, predominantly in the breasts and around the groin. Only minutes away from Wilmot's, Emily turns into Osborne Street at the bottom of Brick Lane, where she spots her friend and fellow lodger, Polly Nichols, stumbling down the road. She didn't recognise her at first, owing to the new black straw bonnet she was wearing. It was good to see her, since although she had lodged at Wilmot's for the last 6 weeks, she had recently been staying somewhere else. As it happened, Polly had just been back to Wilmot's to ask for a bed for that night, but had been told to come back when she had the money for it. Clearly a little drunk, she joked about how she had made three times the amount for a bed already that night, only to drink it all away. The type of service that Polly was supplying that evening could be had for as little as 3 pence, the price of a large glass of gin. Worried for her friend, Emily tries to convince her to come back to Wilmot's. Perhaps they can make a bargain with the deputy, she says. But Polly refuses, deciding instead to try the White House, a lodging only a few minutes away on Flower and Dean Street that permitted sex workers to use their beds. The pair say their goodbyes as a nearby church bell makes the chime for 2:30 a.m. Emily watches her friend stumble down Whitechapel Road as the rains continue to fall. She hated to leave her on her own, especially in such a state, but reassures herself that at 44 years old and no stranger to this world, Polly was more than able to look after herself. An hour later, 39-year-old cart driver Charles Cross steps into the cool early morning air and sets off on his way to work. Turning into the darkness of Buck's Row, he made his way hurriedly toward the sanctuary of the soft light of a gas lamp at the far end. He notices what looks like a tarpaulin lying on the pavement just ahead of him, but as he draws closer, he realizes it is in fact the body of a woman lying unconscious in the street. Spotting his friend Robert Paul at the other end, he calls him over. "I think she's dead," he says, as Paul bends down to examine her, checking her wrist for a pulse. "She's breathing, but it's little if she is," he says, looking furtively about the street. However, not wanting to be late for work, the two men decide to leave her, agreeing only to alert the first policeman they see. Minutes later, PC John Neal, walking his usual beat, turned into Buck's Row. Angling his light into the dimness, he spots the body and hurries over to it. He calls out to the woman but gets no response. Bending down, he holds the light to her face and recoils in horror at the sight of blood leaking out of a deep wound around the neck. Her eyes still open wide, frozen in shock. He placed the lamp on the pavement, illuminating a black straw bonnet left upturned next to the body. Seeing two colleagues enter the street, he calls for them to fetch a doctor immediately. By the time Dr. Llewellyn arrives minutes later, the woman is dead. Inspecting the body at the scene, it was clear that she had bled to death due to the severity of two brutal cuts to her neck, each reaching from one ear to the middle of the throat, cutting all the way back to the vertebrae. Since there are no signs of blood on the woman's clothing, the doctor assumes there are no other injuries. Noticing a large crowd gathering, Llewellyn is keen to preserve what he can of the woman's dignity and have the body removed to a mortuary before continuing his assessment. The crowd stare aghast as the body is lifted from the pavement and placed in the back of a police wagon. As all about the surrounding streets, workers from the nearby slaughterhouses in blood-spattered overalls lend a further macabre edge to the proceedings. With the body having finally been taken away, local resident James Green steps forward into the space and throws a bucket full of water onto the ground before sweeping the resultant bloody wash into the gutter. An hour later, Llewellyn, who is now back at home, receives a call from the police inspector with a hint of grave concern in his voice. They had discovered something else. Soon after, Llewellyn is led into the morgue and toward the body now lying prostrate on an autopsy table. He gasps at the sight of it. It was like nothing he had ever seen before. 3 inches from the left side, at the lower part of the abdomen, ran a very deep, jagged wound. It was only one of 4 similar cuts that ran downward on the right-hand side, as if centered on the woman's womb. All the cuts appeared to have been made with the same long-bladed knife and inflicted with a very deliberate brutality. At the Wilmot Lodging House, Emily Holland wakes to the devastating news that yet another woman had been murdered. For a moment, she sees Polly's face as it disappears into the shadows of Whitechapel Road. A short time later, she learns the news from Mary Ann Monk, another friend of Polly's, whom she had met at Lambeth Workhouse, that the dead woman was indeed Polly. A devastated Emily will later travel to the morgue herself that day to identify her friend. At the inquest to Polly's death, on being asked if he knew anyone who might have done this to his daughter, her father will reply, "I don't think she had any enemies. She was too good for that." Are you always taking care of your family? Do you often take care of others and not yourself? Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. You deserve it. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best, to feeling like yourself again. With Teladoc, you can speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video. Therapy appointments are available 7 days a week from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time. If you feel overwhelmed sometimes, maybe you feel stressed or anxious, depressed or lonely, or you might be struggling with a personal or family issue, Teladoc can help. Teladoc is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches, so they make it easy to change counsellors if needed, for free. Teladoc Therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast. Annie Smith was 28 when she met and married John Chapman in 1869. The following year, the couple celebrated the arrival of their first child, Emily. And 3 years later, a second daughter, Annie, was born. They were joined in 1880 by a brother, John, but the family would soon be torn apart. Owing to some form of disability, Annie and John were forced to send their son to a home. Their misery was compounded when, 2 years later, the couple's first daughter, Emily, died at the age of 12 from meningitis. John worked as a coachman, and though they didn't have a great deal of money coming in, it was at least stable. However, both he and Annie struggled with alcoholism that served only to intensify an increasingly fractious relationship. And by 1885, the pair agreed to go their separate ways. Though many women worked in those days, sometimes taking on entire businesses when their partners died prematurely, the majority of work available was strictly manual and low paid, if you could get it. The situation owed much to a sexist education system, and though some significant changes were around the corner as the 19th century drew to a close, for those like Annie Chapman, options were few and far between. Girls from low-income households, if they were lucky enough to get an education at all, were schooled only in domestic skills. Even for those from more fortunate backgrounds, who might have been given an academic education comparable to boys, it was widely deemed unnecessary, since the only role they were considered destined for was that of a wife and mother, whose only other occupation would be to supervise domestic staff. For Annie, there would be no such luxuries. A semi-regular payment from her husband helped her to just about stay afloat and out of the workhouses, and loneliness was kept at bay in the form of a new boyfriend, John, who made sieves for a living, and with whom she shared a room at a lodging house in Spitalfields, just to the west of Whitechapel. On Christmas Day, 1886, Annie is devastated to hear that her ex-husband, John, has died. She breaks up with her boyfriend soon after. The summer of 1888 sees Annie, now 47, bouncing about from one lodging house to another before managing a period of stability, settling at Crossingham's lodging house on Dorset Street in Spitalfields, home to 300 or so residents of varying itinerancy. In recent months, she had come into an arrangement with bricklayer Edward Stanley, which covered the cost of her bed most weekends. However, the arrangement also complicated matters, since Stanley had ordered the lodging house deputy, Timothy Donovan, not to let her stay if she ever brought another man back with her. A situation rendered all the more fraught, with rumours flying about in the wake of Polly's murder, that some of the recent murders in the area could be linked. London's Metropolitan Police had been homing in on a suspect over the last few days, and by September 5th, the press had a name: Leather Apron. Annie knew of him well. The women all talked about him, warning each other to stay out of his way. Real name John Pizer, around 5.5 foot tall, with dark hair and a moustache. He was said to stalk the streets silently, wearing a deerstalker hat and leather apron, looking for sex workers to extort. He was said also to carry a sharp leather knife at all times. On Friday the 7th, Annie is struggling to get the money together for a bed. If a roof over your head was your only concern, there was always the option of a workhouse, whereby lodging could be sought in return for a sustained commitment of work. However, it was, and is often still the case, that the ruling establishment viewed low-income earners as feckless and lazy, that their predicament was down to their own ineptitude, and as such, were to be discouraged at all times from leaning on the state. As a result, workhouses were designed to offer such unfavourable conditions that people would be discouraged from using them. A midway option could be found in the casual ward, a small section of the workhouse offering little more than a floor, a shared bucket and some bread to those in need. Occupants of the casual ward were entitled to spend one night, after which they were barred from coming back within 30 days, in return for a day's work, breaking rocks or unpicking rope. Having spent the last few days in a casual ward, Annie, who struggled with a serious ailment of the lungs, was determined not to make it three nights in a row. That afternoon, she made a 3-mile trek to Vauxhall, just south of the Thames, where she successfully convinces her mother to give her 5 pence for a bed at Crossingham's. By midnight, however, she had spent it all. Regardless, Annie makes her way to the lodging house and shares a drink with a friend in the communal kitchen before heading out again, hoping to sneak back in later. At just past 1:30 a.m, lodging house deputy Timothy Donovan is informed that Annie has just been spotted again in the kitchen. Moments later, she is at the door of Donovan's office, pleading to be allowed to stay the night, but Donovan refuses, reprimanding her that if she can find money for her beer, then she can find money for a bed. Defeated, Annie asks that Donovan at least save her usual bed, and that she'll be back soon to sleep in it. Four hours later, local resident Elizabeth Long is making her way toward nearby Spitalfields Market when she turns into Hanbury Street. It was here, only the day before, under a bright sun, that a hearse carrying the mutilated body of Polly Nichols, followed somberly by her father, ex-husband and son, had begun its 4-mile journey toward Manor Park Cemetery in Forest Gate. At 5:30 a.m, however, the windows of the undertakers are blacked out, and only silence and darkness is to be found, as Elizabeth hurries along the deserted road. Passing number 29, however, it appears the street is not as deserted as she had thought, when she spots a man, with his back to her, standing in the shadows. He is roughly 5.5 feet tall, late 30s, wearing a dark coat and a low-crowned felt hat. A moment later, she realizes he is talking to a woman. As she passes, Elizabeth catches the end of their conversation. "Will you?" asks the man, to which the woman replies, "Yes." Trying to mind her own business, Elizabeth hurries on and out of the street, just as Albert Kadosh, who lives at number 27, is preparing himself for the working day. Having put on some clothes, he makes his way toward the outhouse at the back of the property. Stepping into the yard, he hears a voice cry out from behind the dividing fence to number 29 on his right. Moments later, he hears something clatter against the fence from the other side. Assuming it to be someone stacking crates for the business next door, he heads back inside. Minutes later, John Davis, a resident of number 29, steps out the front door into a dividing passage between the yard and the street. Surprised to find the gate has been left open, he watches a few people pass by before turning to open the back gate and stepping into the yard. It took a moment for Davis to process exactly what it was he was looking at. The body of a woman left lying on her back, her clothes hoisted up to her waist, and her feet planted on the ground with the knees up. The wet lump of material draped over her shoulder was comprised of intestines that had been completely severed from and lifted out of her stomach. And at the neck, two jagged wounds where she had been savagely sliced from one side to the other. What Davis didn't see, however, before he ran screaming from the scene, was how the uterus, the upper part of the vagina, and two-thirds of the bladder had also been entirely removed. An hour and a half later, in the Prince Albert pub, only 400 yards from Hanbury Street, a sandy-haired man with a large moustache curled at each end, wearing a dark jacket and soft felt hat, nervously approaches the bar, ordering a half pint of ale, making sure to keep his face hidden. Landlady, Mrs. Fidimont, suspicious of his general demeanour, pulls his drink while trying to catch the reflection of his face in a mirror on the back wall. As he takes his glass, she notices blood spatters on the back of his hand. Realizing he is being watched, the man swiftly finishes his drink and leaves. Later that day, the woman found in the yard of 29 Hanbury Street will be formally identified as Annie Chapman. She is the fourth of what the press have taken to calling the Whitechapel murders. Chief suspect, Leather Apron, John Pizer. Pizer makes a perfect suspect for the press, not least of all because he is believed to be Jewish, a cast-iron bogeyman, if ever one was needed. Fears and frustrations mount throughout the East End when news of Annie's murder sweeps through the streets. And with the fixation on Leather Apron being a Jew, it isn't long before some residents are turning their anger toward the Jewish members of their community. But finally, after days spent scouring the neighborhood for John Pizer, on September the 10th, he is apprehended. Sadly for the police and the women of Whitechapel, he has a solid alibi for the night of Annie and Polly's murders. On the Friday, 4 days later, a handful of friends and family watch as Annie Chapman's body is buried, not far from Polly Nichols, in Manor Park Cemetery. By the time Nichols's inquest is drawn to a close on the 23rd, it is clear to the police that although the choice of victim is not by any means out of the ordinary, the manner in which Nichols and Chapman were murdered suggests they are dealing with something that not many had seen before. As the coroner noted in his summing up, the audacity and daring is equal to its maniacal fanaticism and abhorrent wickedness. The suggested motive may be wrong, but one thing is very clear, that murders of a most atrocious character have been committed. Three days later, a letter arrives at the front desk of the Central News Agency, a news distribution service based in the City of London that borders the borough of Whitechapel to the west. On the envelope, written in red ink, it is addressed only to the boss. Inside, there is a letter, also written in red ink, and dated 25th September 1888. It reads, "Dear boss, I keep on hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about Leather Apron gave me real fits. I am down on whores, and I shan't quit ripping them till I do get buckled. Grand work the last job was. I gave the lady no time to squeal. How can they catch me now? I love my work and want to start again. You will soon hear of me with my funny little games. I saved some of the proper red stuff in a ginger beer bottle over the last job to write with, but it went thick like glue, and I can't use it. Red ink is fit enough, I hope. The next job I do, I shall clip the lady's ears off and send to the police officers just for jolly. Keep this letter back, then give it out straight. My knife's so nice and sharp, I want to get to work right away if I get a chance. Good luck. Yours truly, Jack the Ripper. Part 2 of The Square will be out Tuesday, October 2nd. If you enjoy listening to Unexplained and would like to help support us, you can now go to unexplainedpodcast.com/support. All donations, no matter how large or small, are massively appreciated. All elements of Unexplained are produced by me, Richard McLean Smith. Please subscribe and rate the show on iTunes, and feel free to get in touch with any thoughts or ideas regarding the stories you've heard on the show. Perhaps you have an explanation of your own you'd like to share. You can reach us online at unexplainedpodcast.com or on Twitter at unexplainedpod. Now it's time to take care of yourself, to make time for you. Teladoc gives you access to a licensed therapist to help you get back to feeling your best. Speak to a licensed therapist by phone or video anytime between 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. local time, 7 days a week. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast today to get started. That's teladoc.com/unexplainedpodcast.
You wouldn't expect to hear that we're America's third best city for beer like this one. Or home to vibes like this. And this. It might surprise you that we're top 10 for immersive art that's like...
Whoa.
And...
Hmm.
Not to mention, we have one of the top zoos in the country. So can a city with the country's best pro soccer team, ranking as a top culinary destination in the world, be in your own backyard? Yes, Columbus. Plan your summer at experiencecolumbus.com/summer.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles, ready for next day installation, and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com, that's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.